So here we are committing citizen meteorology, and that leads right to this hour's featured interview. It's from a year ago with a citizen scientist, Sharman Apt Russell. The ability to communicate instantly with anyone on the planet makes collaborating on anything a lot easier. We can discuss issues with people on the other side of the planet, we can share recipes, we can explore together, and that's where we'll focus this hour. Citizen science is the term for research committed by people who are not experts in science, but they can certainly contribute a great deal just the same, as our next guest demonstrates. Sharman Apt Russell is the author of Diary of a Citizen Scientist, Chasing Tiger Beetles and Other New Ways of Engaging the World. The book is from Oregon State University Press. Sharman Apt Russell lives in New Mexico and does her citizen science there. She taught writing at a couple of universities and is the author of several previous books, including An Obsession with Butterflies. And her writing has been translated into 9 languages now. Sharman, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Oh, you're welcome. Good to be here.
The Obsession with Butterflies, and that's from 2003, suggests you're not new to citizen science. What got you started?
No, actually, that book helped get me started. I was talking to an entomologist at the Museum of Natural History in London, and he had this phrase. He said, you could spend a week studying some obscure insect, and you would then know more than anyone else on the planet. And that phrase really kind of caught at my heart, and it just kind of stayed with me over the next decade. It just implied this sense of wonder and discovery. I mean, as an environmentalist, like many of us, we kind of mourn losses on the planet. But in that phrase, there's still so much to discover. There's still so much to explore. And the implication is that there aren't enough scientists to do it, that there's lots of room for people spending a week doing something and contributing.
That's the real eye-opening part of the book, is to realize that even though you have scientists who are the best educated people, perhaps, about the Western yellow-bellied tiger beetle, they still have not seen some of the life processes happen for themselves.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, you know, these were my two mentors writing the field guide to tiger beetles, and they've done a great job, but throughout the book are these kind of blank spaces. You know, what is the larval biology of this tiger beetle or of that tiger beetle? And so there's lots of places for us to kind of enter into and help fill in that map of whatever, you know, not just entomology, but so many disciplines in science.
We get reminders every so often. We were talking to a biologist just last week about putting radio transmitters into red band trout in Oregon's largest freshwater lake, because even though they know the fish and know essentially what their life cycles are, they don't know why they leave the lake and go into the tributaries at certain times of the year.
Well, it's extraordinary. I mean, there's so many things we don't know.
So you're not alone by any means. I mean, how fast is citizen science growing, and what are some of the outlets for people who want to use their skills?
You know, there are some programs. I mean, just staying outdoors, Cornell Lab of Ornithology has some like 200,000 people, you know, working on its variety of programs. The Audubon Bird Count, which is one of our oldest citizen science projects, you know, has 70,000-80,000 people working on it. Some of the online programs where you mainly are looking at images that are on screen and you're helping scientists kind of classify and catalog things have as many as 500,000 people cataloging galaxies, for example. So, and this really has happened in the last decade. So I don't even think we're approaching the potential of having hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions of people engaged in looking at the world in this way.
As you pointed out, it gives us a chance to learn some things that haven't been known, and this is certainly underscored by some actual scientists like David Pearson. You mentioned a mentor. He's one of them, isn't he?
Yes, he is, and he's a great advocate for citizen science, as well as being, you know, a wonderful tiger beetle, you know, expert.
And so you clearly enjoy your time in nature. I mean, why did you not become a field biologist yourself?
Right. Well, I was one of those people who always wanted to write, you know, since the age of 8. I did get an undergraduate in conservation and natural resources, so I've always been drawn to nature, despite having grown up in Phoenix, Arizona, you know, which kind of sometimes those of us who come from suburbia or certain cities maybe even feel a greater connection to reconnecting to landscape. So writing was my love, but I have to say I did learn, being a citizen scientist, other reasons I didn't become a scientist, which is it can be very tedious and very detail-oriented, and I'm not always that kind of person.
And you can get your feet mucky and get your clothes wet, and all sorts of things can happen.
Yeah, and I didn't mind that, but I like to be able, when I'm hot and tired, I like to be able to just go inside and have lunch. But if you're really engaged in a citizen science project or a science project, you can't always do that. You have to stay out there where the data is.
Well, and I love the line you wrote about what it's like to be out there. You say, I enlarge in nature. What does that mean?
Right. I enlarge, and partly because I lose myself, I think. I lose, you know, all we have that little mind chatter all the time. What's going on with Charmin? How's my knee feeling? You know, how are people treating me? When are my tax returns due? And, you know, all the stuff that just goes through our mind. And, you know, when I'm outside in nature, I can more easily let all that go and just focus on what's going on around me, which is usually beautiful and interesting. And in that sense, I enlarge, kind of by escaping my small individual personality a little bit.
Slip the surly bonds of tax returns or something.
Yeah, right.
So we established that butterflies were sort of a gateway drug for you. How did the fascination with tiger beetles start?
Well, the fascination with tiger beetles started because I emailed David Pearson, who I knew was an advocate, and said, well, you know, can you help me out here? How would you help me enter into the world of citizen scientists? And so David just seized on that opportunity, which he does to anyone who emails him. Hey, go study tiger beetles because that will help me out. You know, he just grabs on to people as potential graduate students. So he immediately said, well, there's a tiger beetle you could go study, and, you know, if you go there next week, and this is where I would look. And so he really propelled me forward.
So there are more fun interactions between Charmin App Russell and her mentor in the book Diary of a Citizen Scientist. We'll hear more about those when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Charmin App Russell is not a bona fide scientist, but she's very interested in science, and so she started researching some of the interesting critters near her years ago. In a sense, she began practicing citizen science before the term even came into vogue. She wrote a book published by Oregon State University Press called Diary of a Citizen Scientist. The interview is from last year, so we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. So, Charmin, we talked about the tiger beetle fascination. David Pearson was working on this. He knew you were near tiger beetles. So that explains why you got launched on those. I would have thought they'd have tiger stripes, but they look a little more spotted. Why are they called tiger beetles?
Yeah, that's so funny. Well, they're called tiger beetles, I think, because they're so ferocious. As predators, they have these big, heavy mouth parts, and they grab and stab and slice and dismember, and they run. They're the fastest insect we know of. They can gallop 5 miles an hour. And even their larvae, the little grubs that hatch from the eggs and that metamorphosize into the beetle, even they are predaceous and carnivorous and ferocious. So they're very scary up front, I mean up close. So I think that's why we call them tiger beetles.
Okay, that makes sense, because the first encounter for readers is PG-13 at least. I mean, what were they doing to a dead frog?
Yeah, right. They're doing their usual stabbing and jabbing and dismembering and eating. In this case, they're kind of in a pack, and I think that's even a little more frightening. But usually they're solitary hunters, and so they see prey. They have very good eyesight, and they run after it and grab it.
Wow, there's a picture of you in the book. There's quite a few pictures, in fact, of lots of things, but you included. And there's one that shows you with what's called close focusing binoculars. I can imagine there are some opportunities for shock if you're using that device with tiger beetles.
They're wonderful, wonderful things. And you suddenly look down, and you know maybe you're 5 to 10 feet away from the ground, but then you're suddenly in this totally different world. I mean, all those. The insects and the blades of grass, suddenly it's just right up close, and you're right there, and that tiger beetle or that ant or that spider is about as big as Godzilla, And I really recommend it as an experience and perspective.
Have there been some sharp intakes of breath as you looked at things in the close focusing binoculars?
Oh, my gosh, you bet. And sometimes it's because of their mandibles and their, you know, mouth parts. Sometimes something is just so beautiful. I mean, you don't really see the colors when something's so far away. And up close, the design of some insects and, of course, plants too, lizards. I mean, there's just so much elegance and decor going on in nature.
We talked about how fierce they are, which explains the name tiger beetle. And I mean, they truly are fierce. I mean, so, and we talked about the dead frog already. So what do they eat? They are carnivorous, you mentioned. So what else do they eat besides dead frogs?
Right. Well, so a dead frog is huge to a tiger beetle. I mean, a tiger beetle is only a third or a quarter of an inch. So they eat things that are smaller than they are, even tinier ants or they'll also attack prey that's about their same size, of course. So ants, spiders, little beetles, little worms, anything that's flesh, a tiger beetle will attack.
So are they any danger to people?
No, not at all. They're way too small. and actually in the garden and elsewhere, you know, tiger beetles will kind of, you know, scurry around and sometimes, you know, devour things that you mites and so forth that you might not want in your garden. But essentially they have this parallel life in which they neither harm or help us. They're engaged in their own world.
Taking care of tiger beetle business.
Yes, exactly.
You mentioned some of the remote places you've gone to collect beetles, and certainly there are things out there that can hurt you. I mean, how close have you come to things like bears or mountain lions or anything else?
Oh, well, where I live, I'm like a mile from the Gila National Forest, which is 3 million acres of bears and mountain lions. So I'm in that interface, I'm sure some of your listeners are too, between truly wild land and you know, houses with people. So we have mountain lions, you know, come in and grab our goats if we're not careful about our goats. So that was just kind of normal. Rattlesnakes, of course, are always a potential hazard. I find that more exciting to be in a world where there are animals that can challenge you and kind of say, hey, you're not the top dog necessarily.
Right, not the top of the food chain if you're not properly prepared.
Right.
Sharmin Apt Russell's our guest on The Exchange. Her book is Diary of a Citizen Scientist. So it sounds like the approach you have to get to hunt tiger beetles is rather like cougars stalking their prey. Talk about how involved it can get to find them.
Well, they're very, very fast, and they're very small, and they're type A insects. They're hypervigilant, and so you have to kind of stalk up very closely, kind of like a Tai Chi movement, you know, very slow. You don't want their shadow you don't want them to sense your shadow. And then at the last moment, you have to kind of pounce and throw the net down and make sure the edges are flat on the ground. And because the little beetle can escape out of any little air pocket. And so they are kind of hard to capture.
Must be a very fine net then, if you're catching them with that.
Yes, a fine net, and then of course, what I was doing with them is capturing them and then taking them home and raising them up in terrariums. There was relatively little killing of tiger beetles, which was nice. Instead, I was putting them in terrariums where they led these happy lives of mating and feeding and laying eggs, and that's how I came to be among the first documented to see their larva, which, you know, scientists hadn't seen before.
Some choices had to be made about which kind of tiger beetles to go after, and so there are whole bunches of them, apparently, lots and lots of different kinds of tiger beetles, and you mentioned both Rio Grande tiger beetles and the Western Yellow-Bellied. Which were the ones that you were most interested in
I
studying?
I went after the Western because it turned out the Rio Grande were very sparse on the river that year. So I would go over to the Rio Grande and look for them and really couldn't find hardly any. The Western Red-Bellied are just specific to a pretty small area, but there would be thousands of them up on along the Gila River where I live at certain times of the summer.
What is the basic life routine of a tiger beetle? It sounds like, among other things, they really live in hot places.
They do. They do. Now, they live everywhere. They're kind of like human beings in that they're very adaptable. They're all over the world except, you know, the Arctic Circle and a few islands. But the tiger beetles that I was studying particularly, well, all tiger beetles, really, they're kind of solar powered. They do respond to the sun. So they lay these extremely small eggs, and the eggs hatch into a larva, and it burrows down into the soil. And then, as I say, it's very predaceous. It hooks with these back hooks into its tunnel, and it just kind of lunges out at prey. And after it eats enough, it goes through three instars and pupates, and then becomes this adult tiger beetle that is also extremely interested in prey.
I noticed that word instar I hadn't seen before this book. Are these just the life stages of an animal?
Yeah, they it's kind of a nice word, isn't it? Star,
it is.
Instar. So they're you can call them grubs, but that's really not as poetic a word as instar. So they're grubs, and then as they get bigger, they molt, and you know, they molt their skin, and then that's the next instar, the next stage.
Which you got to see at home. I want to spend a little more time outdoors before we bring everybody into the terrariums here. But how harsh have been some of the places you have gone looking for tiger beetles?
How harsh did
you
say? Yeah. Well, you at the beginning of the program, you talked about some harsh weather too. You get up to 109, and yeah, definitely. I mean, you're in the sun, and it's summer, and it's the desert. You know, that's where I live, in a desert environment, so it's pretty hot. Now, the tiger beetles I was studying live by the water, so you can always jump in the river if you get too hot.
Okay, so water nearby anyway, that's always good. Lots of colorful critters to see along the way. It sounds like it's probably pretty easy to get diverted. Tell us about the creatures you refer to as horny toads.
Oh, right. Well, these are those wonderful kind of icons of the desert. They're actually horned lizards, and they have a lot of defensiveness. They kind of spurt blood to kind of scare off someone. I mean, a lot of animals and insects just try and make themselves look scary. So horny toads puff up, and they have all these protrusions, and they squirt out blood, and all this is kind of a way to make you back off. But
wow,
they're so adorable that humans don't. We just pick them up and pet them and kind of love them and then put them back down.
Squirting blood notwithstanding.
Notwithstanding.
Sharman Apt Russell is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's written several books, and her works have been translated into 9 different languages. She has adopted citizen science and has written a book called Diary of a Citizen Scientist, out 2 years ago from Oregon State University Press, subtitled Chasing Tiger Beetles and Other New Ways of Engaging the World. So which of the life cycles then did you go out to collect?
Well, I went out to collect the adults, and then in the terrarium they would mate and lay their eggs, and then I could look at the larva that, you know, came out, that hatched from the eggs.
Okay, and you described a fairly involved capture process. Is this the kind of thing that you spent several weeks to try to get enough to take your terrarium for you?
Yeah. The entomologist in London said you could spend a week studying some obscure insect. I took about a year because I'm slow, I guess. But I did 2 field seasons, 2 summer seasons, where I would be out there for weeks capturing tiger beetles and then rearing them up and doing other studies with them, too, that my mentor suggested.
How did you decide when you had enough? I mean, were you able to figure it out by number, with enough to fill a bottle cap or a half cup or something? Or
I had about, there wasn't a scientific decision. It was kind of like enough's enough. It was in my office. I had about 5 terrariums. Each one had maybe, you know, a dozen tiger beetles running around. I had different soils and different terrariums because we were interested in where the females went to lay their eggs. So what kind of soil did they do that in? That's how. I mean, I had good advice from entomologist mentors who were always just kind of cheerful, and almost everything I did, they said, "Great, good job, Charmin."
I hadn't thought about the fact that it's not just the critters you're collecting, but also the environment as well. So you had to make sure you collected the dirt around them as well, I'm thinking.
Right, right. And find out, the mystery actually still remains where the females fly to lay their eggs. I mean, there's thousands on the riverbank, but I can't find thousands of burrow holes, and nor can anyone else. So we're still kind of working on what kind of soil they prefer, what kind of pH they prefer, where they actually go. There's still some mysteries to figure out.
So once you got the specimens you collected in the field home and got them into the terrariums, what was daily maintenance like?
Oh, their maintenance was feeding them little mini mealworms, which you can order online and which are delivered to your door. And so you're kind of like, you know, the death figure of Kali. You're taking these mini mealworms and feeding them to your tiger beetles. It's happily a natural cycle. Predators mm-hmm. eat, and, you know, so it's not an unnatural thing to do, but it's kind of odd to be involved in it.
Well, the feeding part, I mean, you mentioned the mouth parts and the mandibles and stuff on the adults. I mean, how do the little guys eat and or begin the digestion process? It's sort of digestion before ingestion in some cases, isn't it?
It is. So the little grubs, very small, but they also have these heavy mandibles. And so they grab their prey, they take their prey into the burrow, they, you know, slice them up. The adults first drench the prey with digestive juices, and they kind of the prey kind of dissolve, and then the adults suck them up with a kind of a straw mouth part. Yeah,
blended food for the it's like a tiger beetle smoothie.
It's not for the faint of heart, tiger beetles.
No, I can imagine. Diary of a Citizen Scientist is Charmin App Russell's book, and she's our guest on the Exchange. In trying to acquire the specimens, I forgot to ask about this part. I mean, how difficult is it to tell them apart, the different kinds of tiger beetles?
Well, it's pretty hard from a distance. Once you're looking at them closely, they have wonderful different patterns. You know, so my tiger beetles had kind of, you know, certain number of creamy dots and this little hieroglyphic that looked like the musical note, and that was pretty distinct from other tiger beetles. Some tiger beetles are often very metallic colored. You know, there's a bright green that we have in this area, and they're kind of jewel-like insects. They really have beautiful patterns and colors, and they're like butterflies. They're fairly distinct. To a degree.
The pictures I saw looked like they have some iridescence about them as well. And in fact, I was looking at color pictures thinking that might be a trick of the camera, but the more
no,
I saw them, I realized
yeah.
It actually is on them.
Yeah, their thorax and their head is often iridescent. And then sometimes their wing covers are also a kind of a metallic iridescent, depending on the species. The thing with tiger beetles, they've been collected since the 19th century because they are beautiful and because they are kind of uniquely designed and because there are everywhere. So we have this interesting base of tiger beetles in the world, kind of like we do butterflies. So that kind of helps in terms of looking at have populations changed. They're what we call a biomarker. They help us look at the health of the planet.
Sort of an ecosystem indicator?
Yes, exactly. Right, right. And because we have these long-term records of them, for the very reasons we're talking about, they're beautifully colored and they're interesting and they're distinct and they're easy, you know, relatively easy to collect around the world.
Which makes me think that there's probably a lot of duller-looking insects that we never bothered to collect because they just weren't pretty. They didn't look like jewels.
Yes, right, mm-hmm. right.
But the collections can be helpful. I mean, you mentioned going to New York, and you went to the Museum of Natural History, was it?
Yeah, right. The Smithsonian, it was in D.C., the Smithsonian. Okay. There are big drawers of beetles that you can just kind of pull out and look at. And again, I got more help from the scientists there. I think one thing citizen scientists don't always realize is how much appreciated they are becoming by scientists, and that they really do have a role that scientists are beginning to see and to be grateful for.
Talk about some of the back and forth then, because you wrote a lot back and forth in email with David Pearson, it sounds like. I'm just curious to know, was he... You mentioned that he was always very outgoing and very pleasant about everything, was he getting surprised by the things that you were telling him about the behavior you were observing?
Sometimes, and his coworker very nicely. You know, they hadn't seen the larva, and so they were excited to see that. Barry asked me to look at the ovaries and dissect the ovaries of the tiger beetles in my second summer. And, you know, we found some interesting things doing that. I think that's exciting to them, to mentor people, to pass on their own excitement. And then, yes, to get that information and to add it to the body of information.
So dissecting the ovaries of the tiger beetle, we'll have to wait just a bit. Sharman App Russell from last year is talking about her book, The Diary of a Citizen Scientist. We'll return to the Jefferson Exchange with her in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're learning about the natural world from Sharman App Russell, who is an accomplished writer, not a scientist, but science interested her, and so she began taking part in research into tiger beetles near where she lives. To great effect, she tells the story in a book from Oregon State University Press called Diary of a Citizen Scientist. Sharman joined us last year. We have a phone call or two from the original broadcast a year ago, but we can't take any new calls today. Okay, dissecting the ovaries of tiger beetles, this is going to be a trick. What kind of instruments do you have to have? You already mentioned they're no more than about a third of an inch in height as adults.
Yeah, you have to have this tiny little scalpel, and you have to use this microscope that's kind of uniquely designed for that.
How exciting was this for you to undertake this almost surgical procedure and then be able to relay the information back to the people who know the critter better?
Yeah. Well, you know, at first it was horrific for me. You know, bodies are supposed to be whole, and taking them apart was a little distressing. I got over that in about a few days, and then you're just kind of doing the job and feeling good about how well you do it. And we did learn that the females, we learned some interesting things. We had a theory, and when it was proven wrong, And that's that kind of basic science, you know, where you science fair project, where you have an hypothesis and it's right or wrong, and that's what science is about. So that was pretty exciting.
What was the theory that was proven wrong?
Well, we thought that the tiger beetle females would wait until the end of the season and fly off to the uplands to lay their eggs. But their eggs were actually maturing in their ovaries all through the summer. So they would mate, eat, mate, and then fly away, lay a few eggs, come back to the river, mate, eat, mate, eat, and then fly away, and then come back. So it was, you know, much more of a rich summer experience for them.
Right, I was about to say, it was quite a full summer for them, yes.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't have known this about the eggs being carried in the ovaries all summer long if you hadn't done the dissection.
I wouldn't have, because as I dissected them through the summer, I kept seeing that there were all kinds of eggs at different stages of development. So they were doing that all summer long.
Wow, this is an example of where the world of science has gained a lot from the efforts of just you.
Well, I don't want to overstate it, but it was that, again, that kind of little part on the map of tiger beetles, you know, people just filling in their little bits.
Sure. Let's take a call. We've invited people to talk about their own experiences with citizen science. Here's Digger Ray in Klamath Falls. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, Jeff. We always appreciate your shows, and hooray for the citizen scientists.
Indeed.
When I was young, in the late 50s in Massachusetts, I got an aquarium, and I put dirt in there, and I knew how to identify queen ants. So I got a queen ant, had a little sugar in there, and I thought, oh, she's getting ready to lay eggs. So there she was on the porch, couldn't bring it inside, of course. And imagine my horror when I came out and saw a long line of ants walking and up and down, and they had taken the queen and the sugar and ruined my little project.
And do you have any idea where they took her?
No, I don't. I think they probably ate her.
Did you keep up with ant research after that, Diggeray?
No, I'd like to get back to it. I thought about doing different things because the ants just fascinate me.
Huh, okay. Well, that's a great story. Thanks for sharing that. I appreciate it. So how much of a missionary have you become yourself, Charmin? How much are you talking to other people about taking up citizen science?
Well, a lot, because the book is about what I did, but I also participated in a number of other projects, and I'm just such an advocate because citizen science, you know, is out to children. It's extraordinarily educational. It also is segues into environmental activism. People go out and they monitor invasive species and they look at climate change and they, you know, they're looking at this whole range of phenomena and they become very active in protecting it. It does real science. It affects public policy. It's such a wonderful multi-level, you know, multi-layered approach to the world.
How much of a new vocabulary did you have to learn to do the work? I mean, you mentioned up front some issues with the metric system and Latin names and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You have to enter into that world, and also, you know, you have to learn all these names for beetle parts. But and no matter what citizen science you do, I mean, I think that's part of why it's so exciting, because it can, you really at any time in your life can learn these things, and you can be 8 or you can be 68 and learn this new vocabulary and participate in this new community and do good work. It's all quite accessible to us.
How regular was your maintaining of data? Did you write down new figures every day for what was going on in the terraria at home?
Yeah, pretty much. Or, you know, I certainly tried to do that. And every time I went out in the field, you know, you would record that and kind of look at the terrarium every day. And a lot of citizen science projects are organized by professionals. This was kind of a unusually kind of personal one. But the Audubon Society, lots of government, NASA, they're all organizing these and making them really easy to enter into. And then you enter into it and give your data. They organize it nationally, you know, and then they just have enormous breadth and scope of information that they didn't have before. But they're doing that for you. They're kind of providing you with the forms and providing you with a checklist and telling you, you know, how to do it. And that makes it really easy and scientifically rigorous, too.
We talk about the Christmas bird count of the Audubon Society almost every year, and so when we talked to the Xerces Society last week about the Thanksgiving monarch butterfly count, we asked if it was based on that, and they said, yep. We took their idea. It's a great way to pull a lot of things together from a lot of different people, and you end up with a pile of data. It's up to somebody else to figure out what to do with it all, but you get great information.
Absolutely, absolutely, and so many projects are like that. And more and more, I mean, they're getting very smart, they being the scientists, professionals organizing this, and sharing that data. So you do that data, and then you can look online and see what they figured out from it. And you can start contributing to that analysis, too. I mean, you're not passive as a citizen scientist. And more, that's the case, where you can take a really active, creative role.
How exciting was it for you, Charmin, when the beetles at home began to hatch babies?
Well, it was really exciting, because what David Pearson had said is that they hadn't been able to get that to happen. In the one time they tried, because there's so many species to look at. So I immediately emailed him and said, my babies are hatching, you know, my babies are hatching. And he emailed back, oh, that's great, Charmin, wonderful. So, you know, human world, we're full of small happinesses.
No doubt. So what kinds of things are they busy working on in their own labs, David Pearson and company, while you're working on this kind of stuff?
Right. Well, they as experts, they go around, you know, David will often go overseas. I mean, if Madagascar, for example, wants to do a park and they want to assess its biodiversity, they'll have people come and look at the birds. They'll have people come and look at the butterflies. And they'll have people come look at the tiger beetles. Mm-hmm. So, you know, David Pearson will go do that. And Barry Knisely is looking at endangered species and at where tiger beetles are moving around in this country. So they travel, and you know, they're the real people who have the big picture and who can help use tiger beetles to look at climate change, look at biodiversity, to look at protection.
Well, that raises a question for, as you just tromped out in nature to look for tiger beetles along any one of a number of different waterways, what did you notice? I mean, how broad could your focus be on things like the general level of quality of the environment or whether it had been degraded or not?
Yeah, well, you see it right away. I mean, if I'm walking along the river looking at tiger beetles, I might also notice there are tamarisk trees here and that's an invasive species. You know, I'll be certainly looking at the level of the water. So as soon as you get out in the outside world, you just are engaged with its general health, I think, if you're paying attention. And that's what being a citizen scientist helped me. I mean, I've always been a big walker, and I'm a runner, and I, you know, live here, and I'm outside a lot. But it's easy for me to get engaged in my own head or just to go through the landscape as quickly as I can because I'm into exercise. The tiger beetles really made me slow down, look at things, stand in one spot for a long time, and that helped me see the health much better.
Okay, let's take a call here. We have Don and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sharman Apt Russell, the author of Diary of a Citizen Scientist.
Good morning, Sharman. And I just want to tell everybody to learn about the life in the desert. I had a biology professor, Dr. McMenamin, who took his group of disagreeable students out to the desert, and within a day, we saw what was really happening there, which looks like nothing, and we learned about the oldest plants perhaps in the world, the creosote bushes and the gourds and the ocotillo and the,
yeah,
and the cactus, and the marvelous way that they adapt to little changes in the weather and survive and thrive. And then I had a chance to live in New Mexico for a while. What part of New Mexico do you live in, by the way?
I live in the southern part, southwest, so we're about 100 miles from the border.
Oh, yeah, there's some beautiful country there. I was in Santa Fe, and that's another beautiful place that everyone should visit, the second oldest city in the country, and with some original buildings, by the way. And but just,
yeah,
the biodiversity in that area, you're up at 7,000 feet and 10,000-foot mountains, and it's just an amazing thing. But once Dr. McMenamin had introduced us to what was going on in the desert, you never look at it the same way when you're there. It becomes, you can imagine what the native people experienced, having all the wisdom that they accumulated, that they had accumulated about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they,
right.
And they had to live off the landscape too. Don, thanks for the observations. And I mean, as somebody who grew up in the desert, you're going to have a different perspective from a guy like me who grew up in suburban New York. But because the feeling you get when you live in a leafy place like that is, oh, the desert, nothing lives out there, but lots of things live out there.
Yes, right. And I actually think Don's observation is so true, but it extends to almost any ecosystem. You know, if you're in the Arctic, glacial wilderness, if you're on the ocean, Eastern Oregon, you look closely at almost any healthy ecosystem, and it is so rich, and there's so much going on.
Another call here from Gloria in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. I was just noticing one day when I was looking at some garden snake that it was crawling in and out of branches and trees. It was on the ground, but it was crawling in and out and over. It kept flicking its, tail out, to flick his tongue out to see what he was getting into. I noticed that it was, every time that it come across a branch or something, it would go up and over and up and over and flicking its tongue and feeling its way. Suddenly occurred to me, in Australia, do snakes go down and under? And if they didn't go up and over and down and under, they could really you know, if they didn't do one thing all the time, they could literally tie themselves in the knot.
Oh, that's a good point. Right. If they didn't,
wondering if anybody had any information on that.
You might be the first. Let's see if Charmin has any input for us. Thanks,
well,
Gloria.
Well, that's the beauty of citizen scientists. You might be the first, right?
Oh, that's great. So how attached did you get to the tiger beetles that you were busy raising in the terraria?
Oh, you know, tiger beetles kind of can have personalities. I mean, almost anything can. I mean, there were some really aggressive ones and some less so. And you know, so you get attached, but then you also put them outside and they go on with their lives too. Mm-hmm.
So, Charmin, finally, you describe it as a renaissance and a revolution. Is there any downside you can see to citizen science?
I can't see much downside, frankly. They're really working. They really understand now how to make citizen science rigorous and scientifically accurate. And people's initial fears that, you know, there'd be bad science have been pretty much solved. I still think there still needs to be a lot of work in making science, citizen science, more diverse. Most citizen scientists are middle class and are Anglo and educated, but that's really changing fast, and it has the potential to change fast because citizen science is all about being inclusive. You know, it's all about jumping over boundaries of age and of class and of status. It's about anyone can do this.
You may inspire lots of people to follow in your footsteps, which are easily followed. It's almost like a recipe book, Diary of a Citizen Scientist, Chasing Tiger Beetles and Other New Ways of Engaging the World. Charmin App Russell wrote it and joined us on The Exchange. Charmin, thanks so much.
You bet.